Okay, so Bershus HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Rav Shechter Shlita, Talmidim. I'm here to give a talk today about Elisha ben Avuya. I was told at certain points to give a lecture, to give a shiur. So I decided I was going to do a lecture shiur. So I'm not going to exactly go through the Gemara with you as maybe one of your Rebbeim would. And I'm not just going to give a complete academic talk as some people would either. I'm going to do something a little bit in the middle. Although right before I start, I would like to say that I want to thank the three people. Number one, Dr. Adler, for giving me the opportunity to speak today and for teaching me about the Acher. He's very interesting to me. And he's gotten me to do many, many good things, interestingly enough. My wife, who for some reason gives me all this time to learn. I'm very lucky. And also to my Chavrusa, Aharon Shalom, a lot of these thoughts, although I might think are mine, are actually probably his. Okay. So who is the Acher? Who's Elisha ben Avuya? So he was a genius. So his prime Talmud was Rabbi Meir, right? And so we know that Rabbi Meir was a complete genius. He was such a genius that people would not go to his shirim. He was such a genius. A lot of other people's shirim were a lot more popular. So Elisha ben Avuya also delved into Pardes, which is mysticism, and he happened to do this with the three biggest Rebbeim of his time, which is Shimon ben Zoma, Shimon ben Azai, and none other than Rabbi Akiva. If you look in the Chagiga and the Yerushalmi, his Torah is considered apparently quite important. And he managed to keep up this reputation of being one of the biggest Talmudic scholars of his time, with studying Greek philosophy and learning Greek, which at that time period was an extra language. He obviously had a lot of skills. Top of that is I'm going to go through a little bit later. So when he's going with Rabbi Meir Bala Nes, whatever, he finds out while he's having a very intense discussion about Torah where the Tchum Shabbos is just by counting the steps of his horse. So really intelligent. And one last point to drive that home. So there's a story that's brought in Brachos. It's actually brought in other places. It's expounded in Brachos. So Chana and Eli, right? So Chana gives Eli Shmuel. He's in the Beis HaMikdash learning. And so Eli says, Shmuel's got to go. He's embarrassed me. And he tells Chana, I'll give you a better son. It's one interpretation of what he says. I'll give you a better son. So Shmuel was incredibly smart. He's according to the Yon Yaakov, he started talking at birth. And Chana, although you know, she hears, wow, I have the opportunity to have an even smarter son, could get more in Torah. According to the Maharat Chayas, she was worried, she said no. Why? Because people, the smarter they get, the more risk there is. So she was worried that he might get, that if she got another son, and that it was smarter, that it'd be so smart, and it'd be very risky. And in the example that the Maharat brings is that he might, God forbid, get to be so intelligent that the chances would be that he could follow Derech, just like Elisha ben Avuya, even though he lived later than that. Okay, so how does someone like this fall off the Derech? Dr. Fine was talking about this last year, and someone cracked a joke, but it was really interesting. Imagine the biggest Rav today. Take any of the Gedolei Yisrael. Imagine them just falling off the derech. How can it be so? How can you conceive such a thing? The Tana, Elisha ben Avuya, one of the biggest Tanaim of his time, just falls off the derech. One of the biggest leaders of the Jewish people at that time just falls off the derech. It's really interesting. One has to ask the question. And there's not so much that's written about him. So this is what I'm here to talk about. So let's have a little bit of background knowledge of who this person is. So he had a very competitive upbringing, as this is how I see it. So in the Yerushalmi, it brings down the story of his birth, his bris, to be more exact. I'm not going to talk about absolutely everything. But in any case, so Avuya, which is his father, decides to have a bris for Elisha, his son. And he's known as, Avuya was known as one of the Gedolei Yerushalayim, which is obviously, as you'll see later in the Agadah that I'm bringing down, that I don't think it's Torah that he was considered one of the Gedolei Yerushalayim, Gedolei Yisrael. It's probably that he was rich. He throws a massive banquet. He says he invited absolutely everybody. There was singing, tinkling food. And among the people there are Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. So he looked at one another and said, listen, these people are partying and doing what they do. Let's see what we do. So go off to the room and they start to learn Torah. And they learn Torah so intensely that Esh comes down from Shemayim and encircles them. So Avuya walks in, he sees this happening, and he says, what have you come to burn down my house? That's exactly what he tells them. They said, no, you don't understand. Fire is Torah. And when you really are into Torah properly, mamash, a fire from heaven comes down. Avuya is so amazed by this occurrence that he says, I want to set aside my son for Torah now. So it's just because of the prestige. He wants his son to have the ability to bring fire down, whatever it may be. He sees the kochos of Torah, but just the koach, and that's all he cares about. So I'm assuming that Elisha, as a father, his father figure, was not one that was, let's say, interested in Torah, the Shema. I also think that he was jealous of Rabbi Akiva. So there is one Mishnah that's brought down in Pirkei Avos that has Elisha ben Avuya's name attached to it. And so I'll read it in English. Okay, so one who studies Torah as a child, to what can he be compared or likened? To ink written on a fresh paper. And one who studies Torah as an old man, to what can he be likened? This is to ink written on smudge paper. This is a Tana, Elisha ben Avuya, is very interested in intellectual pursuits. He becomes one of the biggest Gedolei Israel, and then out of nowhere, this 50-year-old comes in and steals the show, probably, for him. Someone who's not religious comes in, Rabbi Akiva, and all of a sudden, he's the talk of the town. Everybody wants to hear from Rabbi Akiva. So I could imagine why he would be jealous. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the one Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that's brought down happens to be the one that kind of can be seen as an attack to Rabbi Akiva. That he's an older man and his Torah is not as valuable as someone who learned younger, such as himself. So, more than that, again, he just wanted to know information. So, it says in Maseches Chagiga and Tes Vav Amad Aleph, base, in the bottom, that whenever he would get up from the base medrash, that books, heretical books, would fall from his lap and he would constantly be singing Greek songs, etc. So, he ignored the warnings of Chazal. He was just interested in the deep philosophical knowledge. And that was all that there was. He just had to have it. It was so enticing to him. That was his biggest taiva. Okay. So, yeah. The story goes like this, right? The four people that went into Pardes, and as I told you it was before us, it's Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Acher, and Rabbi Akiva. Elisha ben Avuya's name is also Acher. Okay? And so, they get there, and Ben Azai dies. Ben Zoma goes crazy. Acher says to Ben Kitzis Ben Tios, he chopped down the saplings of Pardes, whatever that exactly means. It's probably impossible to know. And Rabbi Akiva's the only one that's asked again. He goes out in Shalma. So again, I'm not sure how happy that Acher was, knowing that Rabbi Akiva's the only one that goes out. But his colleagues, Ben Zoma and Ben Azai, he ruined their lives. I think that this entire thing was his idea. The beginning of this, so they go to Pardes. So Rashi says that they went up to Pardes using Hashem's name. Okay. So, yeah. So in the beginning of this parak, it's actually called Ein Dorshim. So there's a few things. Yes. So I'm saying I think it is. There might be a source. So as a prelude, I on purpose didn't look at absolutely every source because of one of my rabbim I was speaking to. Sometimes it's better to think and say it's you have an idea. It might not be right, but you take the information they have there in front of you and you see what you can get. I think it is. I don't know why everybody would be running to find out about the Maaseh Merkava, especially because, as I'm about to say, well, if you look earlier in the parash, you see that people are discouraged from doing it so easily and so publicly. But on top of that, so this parak is called Eishin, and one of the things that this Mishnah over here teaches us is that you're not supposed to be learning about the Maaseh Merkava with more than two people in total, meaning the teacher and the student. Yes?
Pardes is the first two Maaseh Merkava.
So some say that Pardes is the, or entering Pardes, whatever exactly that was delving into the ideas and concepts behind the Maaseh Merkava. And so again, we have a warning in the beginning in the Mishnah over here, in Yud Aleph Amud Beis, that one is not supposed to do this. It's dangerous. Why? I think this is the reason. This is Shai exactly shows you what can happen. Lost three Gedolei Yisrael in one shot. So, what is interesting is Tosfos says over here that they didn't physically go anywhere. People take this very literally. Maybe it is meant to be taken literally by some people. I'm not exactly sure. But Tosfos says that they went up just their thoughts. It's as if they were in Shemayim. Okay. So Rabbeinu Chananel talks about exactly what was exactly going on here. They would all meditate and get into the proper state. They'd think about the right thoughts, and they would go through a humongous tahara process. It was extremely complicated and extremely intensive. I don't think it'd be very easy for. It's actually impossible for us to do it today. Unfortunately, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. We don't have a Parah Aduma. But in any case, so the way what they were able to do though is get their mind in such a place that they experienced being somewhere else. So they had, I guess you could say, an altered brain state. They were able to do something so incredibly intensive just with their minds or with their neshama. They were actually able to experience themselves being at a different place. You know, some people today, they do that or something like that by, you know, taking drugs, I guess, right? But they're able to control this experience and a pure experience, at least to some extent, and imagine they were in Shemayim. They had such control over their bodies that they were able to transport themselves to a different place, even if literally they were just standing, as Rabbi Nachmanel says here, in the fields. So, anyway. Yeah. It says that Acher was Kitzis Benetios, right? So what does that mean? The Gemara talks about it. So, this is exactly what happened, apparently. So he went up and he saw Metatron. Metatron is trying to figure out a way to explain it. He's basically the archangel, the main angel, I guess, of God. He's up there, and as Rashi says in different places through the Torah and through Tanakh, that this is the angel in which God acts on the world. And the Gematria of Metatron is Shakai. This is exactly how God acts on the world. Now anyway, the Gemara says here that he was given permission to sit down and write the merit of all of Yisrael. That was his job. So he sat down in a chair in heaven, and he writes down the Zchusim of Yisrael. Now, Elisha ben Avuya, still Elisha ben Avuya at that time, makes the following statement through a thought process. He's thinking out loud. He says, wait a minute, I learned that there's no sitting in heaven, there's no competition, there's no back of the head, and there's no weariness. You know, angels don't get tired. So then, here I am seeing something that's seeing someone or something that's sitting down over there in heaven. So God forbid, there's Beis Rishuyos, Chas V'Sham. That's what he says. There must be two gods. And he says that out in heaven. So he gets in trouble. So what do the Malachim do? Malachim take out Metatron. They whip him 60 times in order to show Elisha ben Avuya that this thing is totally subservient to Kadosh Baruch Hu. There's only one out there. And then it says Metatron was given a new job. His job was to sit down and to erase all this chusim of Acher. To wipe every single mitzvah he's ever done, and to leave all of the sins that he's done, and that would be it. So then a Bas Kol comes out and says, Shuvu banim shovim chutz mi Acher, the Yerushalmi version, Shuvu banim shovim chutz mi Elisha ben Avuya, which is everybody can come back into tshuva, but not you. That's it, you're doomed. So Elisha ben Avuya, or Acher, I guess at that moment, says, oh, well, you know what, I guess it's better now to just might as well go and do whatever I want, because there's no one in the Canadian anyway. I might as well ruin my entire life and, you know, just enjoy the physical pleasures of the world. While this doesn't make a, it's not, I don't think it's so obvious, it doesn't make 100% sense to me. So what was really his mistake? Was his mistake that he was thinking out loud? Or was his mistake that, you know, that he didn't do tshuva? Meaning there's two different ways that you could look at the Sagadata. One is that mamish, he said something that, I mean, you are in one of the most holiest places ever. You have the schos of seeing or understanding certain aspects of divinity that people don't generally usually get to. And out of all of that, you just happen to say out at that exact moment, at that exact time, there must be two gods, Chas V'Sham. So maybe that's his mistake, and that's it, he really was doomed. Or maybe it was how he dealt with the actual tshuva. The Bas Kol told him that he can't come back. So what? So maybe he's still... The whole entire point of life, Elisha ben Avuya should have known at that point, is that the only purpose to life is to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's the only thing that has objective existence and lasts forever. Your life is actually totally meaningless if you really can't do tshuva. If I was Acher, I'd probably kill myself right there. I have no purpose anymore. It doesn't make sense that he would just continue on his life enjoying the physical pleasures. I doubt that he really thought he'd come back. I think he was just being stubborn, or he was being bitter. And I'll explain that. So, as soon as this agadata is over with Metatron, the next thing that's mentioned is he instantly goes out, and he finds a zona, he finds a harlot, and he decides, okay, that's it, I'm going to start enjoying myself. And that's actually, the harlot is the one that gives him the name Acher. Also, again, I think, all his friends basically died. And this idea, like I said, may have been his, I'm not exactly sure. And he was completely obsessed with this knowledge that he had to find out about Mentatron, he had to find out about the Maisa Bekov, or whatever it was. And maybe it was because of him that his friends died. Maybe that's why he was so bitter. As we'll see as we go through the story, the impression that I get is that he knew that he could have done Shuvah, but he had nothing, he wanted to do absolutely nothing. He wanted no shaychas, no connection at all to Yiddishkeit. None. Yes?
How was he able to get up to heaven if he had all these, conflicting ideals and all these conflicting actions?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer. I don't know. Okay, I could also say that also he was. Yes?
I'd just like to say that my understanding is that the definition of shuffle is part of this. It's a book.
Yes? So there's the bit, Ben Yoyada says it was delving into the information of how to repair the Chet of Adam HaRishon. So there are a few opinions of what that is. I'm just covering one particular angle because of time constraints. But yes, that's important. It's an important point to make. I'll take one more question for right now. Yeah.
If we go with the Bab, is there sort of a Shuvah Ram Shuvah because of the Acher? Doesn't he give in a Lishman of Rebuke to himself the name Acher?
That is an excellent, excellent point to make. So, it would be Hashem. I think it's the Iyun Yaakov, although don't quote me on that. But I think he's the one that says that it's Hashem giving him that name. Shuvah Ba'am Shom Chutz Mi Acher is the boss call. It's not Elisha speaking.
I understand that, but then Acher decides to say, oh, that must be me, and then he goes to the Zona.
Well, I mean, he's the only one being spoken to. So I think if, Chutz Mi and then use a pronoun, it's probably me. Right? He's the only person that's being addressed to. So also, I could say that he was better because, he got a decree for his error. He saw, but yet his friend, whatever you want to say, that he probably also felt a little bit ill. Rabbi Akiva, he went out and shalom. He actually succeeded. He mamish 100%. He refused to practice anything in Judaism except for, again, learning. Again, which I think just backs up the whole idea that this person was a massive intellectual, and that's all he cared about. He started using Torah as just a study, God forbid, as one studies mathematics. One has to be careful of falling into such a trap even here. You have Torah, Mada, you have all these very interesting things, but you have to make sure that you treat Torah properly. So, in the Yushami, and it's mentioned here in the Bavli as well, it says that he killed children. That Acher killed children after this. One interpretation is he actually saw a child and he killed them. Another is that he caused them to go off a derech, which I guess is just as good as killing. So this is what he did. He would see children that'd be learning in the Beis Midrash, very smart students. He'd walk in and they would understand this is someone of a great, great mind. And he would say, listen, I know you're going to be a woodcutter. And I know that you're going to work in the mines, and I know that you're going to do this, and you're going to do that. So what does Torah have anything to do with it? He would make a convincing enough argument, and as the Yerushalmi says, all of them would get up and leave and go off the derech. That's what he would do with his spare time. Again, he was very bitter. Very bitter. He was stubborn too. So, as we said before, Rabbi Meir was his Talmud, his prime Talmud. And Rabbi Meir loved him very, very much. And we see that throughout all of their reactions. So, he's asked a few times by Rabbi Meir if he wants to do teshuva. So he says, no, I already heard, you know, shuv ban shuv bim chutz miacher, I can't go back. Rav Meir tries again and again and again. So there's one story that I really want to bring up, and so you just get a little bit more of an idea of who he was. So Rav Meir, this is brought down in the Yerushalmi, he was giving a shir, a very complex shir on Shabbos. And in the middle of the shir, he hears someone just by saying outside, ah, there's your teacher, he's going outside. In the middle of the shir, Rav Meir got up and left to go see his teacher and learn Torah from his teacher, even at that time. That's how much he cared about him. Even at that time, he stopped in the middle of the shir, just left tons of people there, and he just left. So they have this conversation about Torah, and then Elisha ben Avuya, or Acher at that time, looks over at Rabbi Meir and says, okay, I've measured the steps of my horse, and I know that until this exact point, there's a Tchum Shabbos, so you should turn around. So Rabbi Meir Mamash, I get the impression that he's crying or something. He looks at his master and he says, come back. So Acher says no. So eventually, this happens a few times where Rabbi Meir just asks him passionately, just come back, and Acher just says, no, I heard it, I can't come back. One time Rabbi Meir just has the end of it. You know, he takes him and Imam throws him into a base medrash. But you see, again, he's very stubborn. So what does Acher do? So he asks a bunch of children to tell him over a certain psukim. So this is a custom that they used to do back in the times of the Gemara, before that even, that they used to go and they used to ask children what are they learning, and it could have been, you know, seen as a sign. So every single child would give him some sort of pasuk that, it's it, you're not coming back, a lot of negative things. Again, I don't have time to go through all of it now. But, so what Rabbi Meir did was take him from base medrash to base medrash to base medrash until he went through all the base medrash that there were. And that's how stubborn he was. Rabbi Meir really tried everything. Now, there's one thing I want to bring up. This is exactly how far he went. So there was one child, the last child that he asked, the very, very last one, the last base medrash in, the, I guess, the town. So he said, psukli psukach, tell me over whatever you're learning. So he said, ulurasha amar alokim malach alasaprach pegamri. Right. So there's this pasuk, ulurasha amar alokim malach alasaprach pegamri. So what to Rasha, Hashem says, what is there to say over to you? So this particular child, he was either scared or he stuttered. So he stuttered a little bit. And instead of saying Ula Rasha, he said Ula Elisha. To Elisha, what does Hashem have to say to him? Nothing. So there are two mandamas over what exactly happened. Number one is Elisha took out a knife and he said, I'm gonna cut you, meaning the whatever he was holding, until 13 different pieces. And there's another one that says, no, I'm gonna take this knife and I'm gonna cut you up, kid, into 13 different pieces. That's how far that one of the humongous Tanaim at that time, you felt to such a level. So what happened? What happened to Acher after this? He lives a life of just total pain and suffering and being completely cast out by everybody he knows except for Rabbi Meir, who constantly keeps trying to bring him back. Yes?
I think it's important to make a distinction between, I mean, I don't know which one you're trying to do, but are you trying to decipher who Acher was, or are you trying to decipher how Chazal and Mishnah Gemara paint him and for what purpose? Because we're just blending it all together as if it's all one thing, but really one could attempt to distinguish between historical fact of what we know about what he was and all these mandamars and all these comments that try to teach a lesson through him.
Actually, I'm trying to understand him and his motive, because all we have is, the problem is that the best we can do is look back on what we have to understand why he did this, but we have to make a compilation of everything we know, so we need historical fact plus personal perspective on it. It's the only way you can possibly understand who he is and what was going through his mind, because historical fact doesn't tell you anything besides what he did. But others' perspective, whether they're biased or not, do give you a better understanding.
Well, we still have to be aware of how the comments that are made about
it. I know, but
that are made 100 years later, we have to distinguish between that and anything that he exactly said or
so. I'm taking what's written in the Gemara as fact, and it might be absurd.
It's not intellectually. It's not
okay.
It's not the way to learn Gemara. Also, I mean, it's different between a Maimra and the Stama Sugya. I mean, you're just
Meaning, what I'm saying is that there are certain versions that are given in the Gemara, and I am unwilling to go outside of the versions that are given by the Gemara for two reasons. Number one, I don't have any other evidence to what he could possibly have said. This is the only evidence I have. Number two is, that would be saying that the Gemara is wrong.
Not just what I'm saying, to maintain the awareness of the difference between what we know as fact about, as close to as fact as possible, and what we know as various, you know, using him as sort of this example of what we teach about what we don't want people to be like, or what an Acher represents. But so, it's not intellectual at the fact that they're all the same, not distinguished between the
two. So, I think I brought up the two Manda Amars, and I've been bringing up the different Manda Amars of exactly his actions throughout what I've been speaking about. What you want to derive from that, I mean, if you think that you have the authority to make a bunch of drushas or whatever it is, I mean, it's a lot of, there are definitely a lot of mafarshim on this, a lot of commentaries. So I guess you're free to do so. I'm only sticking to what I see, unless, as I said before, I say this is what I think. It could very well be wrong. I'm very young and I'm not very experienced in learning, at least I don't think I am. So, at the very end of his life, the following story is brought out. Acher starts to, he's dying, he's sick. So Rav Meir finds out about this, and he runs to visit his master. And so he asks one more time, Rav Meir's been doing this forever. He says, do tshuva. Do tshuva. And so Acher gives in a little bit. He says, do you really think anybody would accept me if I do teshuva? Do you think really Hashem would be makabla? He says, of course. You bring man to a crushing point and you say, return, O sons of men. Now Rashi explains that out as you bring agonies, people to get them very weak till they're near death, and still you can tell him, Hashem cries out, he says, do tshuva, even when you're right on death's bed, you're about to die, do tshuva, it's never too late to do tshuva. So Acher cries, and he does tshuva, Rav Meir stands there, and I think he says, holds his hand, I'm not quite sure, I don't remember, but Acher cries, he does tshuva. Although this is a really beautiful story, and makes me very emotional. He still goes to Gehenna. But not immediately. So as we learn again on Tesvav Amud Beis and the Gemara, so Acher was in limbo. He was neither in Gan Eden and he wasn't in Gehenna either. It's a very scary thought. Anyway, so Rav Meir says, you know, it's not fair that my master, he's not getting a trial up there. He's in limbo. It's the worst sort of thing ever. He deserves a trial. When I pass away, when I go to the next world, I'm going to make sure that Acher gets a trial. He deserves one. He should get the Gan Eden eventually one day, all the Torah and everything that he taught me. So when Rav Meir passes away, smoke starts arising from Acher's grave. And remains that way for some while. Now Rabbi Yochanan sees this, and he says, look, Acher was one of us. He was one of the leading rabbis of this generation. Is it just that we're going to allow him to just burn in Gehenna the entire time? He gets passionate, he says, if I go up to Gehenna, or down, however you want to say, and I go into Gehenna, who's going to stop me? Who's going to snatch him away from my hand? So Rabbi Yochanan enters Gehenna, and he leads Acher to Gan Eden by the hand. And the guards of Gehenna, they do nothing. It's a really amazing sort of imagery. Acher, for everything that he did, he still had Torah by his side. He was still he still contributed immensely to the field of Torah. He still continued to learn Torah even after. He unfortunately fell off the derech. But he got to such a level that the rabbis really respected him and understood that he was one of them. And so Rabbi Yochanan went, and it says that the guards of Gehenna just mamish stood by. He went in and he took Acher by the hand and led him all the way to Gan Eden. And the smoke stops. So you all read a book called As a Driven Leaf. And it's an interesting book. But I kind of see Milton Steinberg, the author of it, I think he really puts himself in the book a lot. It's the last thing I'm going to touch on. I'll take a few questions, and we'll see if I still want to talk or if we'll just stop for the day. But he paints this picture of Elisha ben Avuya that doesn't 100% exist. And I feel like it's a lot, what, Mr. Steinberg was really kind of all about. I think he was a conservative rabbi. And one begs the question, he obviously was intelligent. One begs the question is, if you're so intelligent, shouldn't it be obvious that you'd be able to realize, you know, that the conservative and the reformed way is not proper? And I feel there's a lot of conflict throughout the novel, and I think some of that conflict is theological, right? Acher is trying to figure out what to do in his own story, and I think he battled with this. And so I'd say that Milton Steinberg is an Acher himself, someone who delved into Torah and tried to understand it, but just couldn't take it the right way, or just became bitter from it. That's the impression that I got from the story. And is there any questions or comments? I'll take them now. None. Okay. Yes?
Years ago, Rabbi Soloveitchik used to have a yard site by his father in Gimelschwad. And there's a big thing. Every year he would give a shiur at least 4 hours long. He would give a shiur in halacha for 2 hours, and then he would give a drasha and agada for 2 hours. For several years in a row, he was obsessed with Acher. Because Acher fell in because he read philosophy, and Soloveitchik taught philosophy, and he thought that he didn't fall in. So I imagine that's why he was obsessed, kept on talking about Acher. I was very young at the time, I was 13, 14. I remember vaguely him talking about Acher a lot. I remember one thing that he mentioned was, in the outside function, he thought that the Baskol just said, Shuvah Banim Shavav. And Acher, as a Elisha ben Avui, as a Tana, the Tanoim had a drasha. Whenever it says Acher, so they call make a drasha, Acher v'loy Bein. Whenever it says Bein, the Chachamim will say Bein v'loy Acher. Yeah, psukim like that. It says if someone is magnish a field, someone donates the real estate to Hekdish, so the gizbar sells it to Ishacher, so then the owner doesn't get it back when it comes to Yom. So the Gemara has a drosh in Erchin, but if the gizbar shall Hekdish sells it to the son of the one who donated it, then the father does get it back when it comes to Yom. Then you have another drosh. So the Ishacher, so the Gemara says, I forgot the other pasuk. There's another drasha in Yeshnechlin about Bein Goloy Acher. The Gemara understands the Torah about Pet Darshans, that Bein means the exclusion of Acher, Acher means the exclusion of Bein. So they thought that Pasuk just said, called upon all of mankind to do Shuvah. Shuvah, Banim, Shavah. Bishop Ben Agui was a Tana, said he knew the drasha, so he made a drasha. Shuvah Banim, Bein Goloy Acher. One who's so far away, one who sins so much, his tshuva will not be accepted. That was his drasha. And then he decided on himself that he is an Acher. He thought the Baskol didn't say it. This was his own assessment of his own situation.
So
I remember one thing that he suggested. Yeah.
What was the Avera of Elisha Ben Agui, and what did he do that was considered a sin at that time?
My impression was that I think there's a Gemara at the end of Chulin that Elisha Ben Avuya was bothered with Sadiq Verado Rosh HaBetoklo, that he lived to, I think he lived through the Churban, Rabbi Kiva lived through the Churban by shame, and the Romans were torturing people to death, they were torturing people terribly, so he was bothered by people after the Nazi persecution. So many Jews gave up the religion. How can it be that the Jewish religion is true? How can God allow such a terrible thing to happen? That's what the Chumash speaks about. The Torah says in Hazinu, the people will ask him, where was God when all of this was happening? So that's what they were asking after the Churban Hashem. Where was God when all of this was happening? The Gemara says, on the smaller region, not only the whole Roman persecution, on a small level, the Gemara says, he saw a child went to fulfill Kibabinim. Father told the child to fulfill the mitzvah of Shivu HaKan. So both by Kibabinim and by Shivu HaKan, the Torah promises a reward explicitly for Eches Yom. So the child went to do the both mitzvahs, which each one is promised Eches Yomim, and the child fell down the ladder and he got killed. So he was bothered with the question, Tzadik V'Ra'ad HaShem Tov, but obsessed with the problem. So he figured, it can't be. See, it's a kasha, it's Tzadik V'Ra'ad HaShem Tov, it's a kasha. If you believe that there's only one God in charge of everything, God knows everything that's happening, God is a good God, and he has the ability to intervene. He has full control of the whole world. If you say there's more than one God, so there's no kasha, so there's a God of good and God of evil, one God is in charge, One God gave the religious laws and the moral laws, and one God created the world. So then there wouldn't be any kasha. The whole kasha is, we believe there's only one God. God knows everything that's happening, and he cares, and he's a good God. He has the ability to intervene, but he doesn't intervene. How can it be? Well, yes, there's a kasha. So he gave up the whole religion. He said it can't be. Like the Jews after the Second World War, many of them gave up the religion. If I'm not mistaken, the Talmud Yerushalmi says that he was so upset about the falseness of the Jewish religion, he told the Roman government how to make Zeres Hashmat against the Jews. The Chachamim composed the Tefillah of Olam HaShinim. They had him in mind. They had in mind Elisha ben Avi. They didn't want to say explicitly, but they meant the Jewish Olam HaShinim. They didn't mean the Jews who were destroying the Jewish religion. He was just obsessed with the kasha. It's a very strong kasha. Tzadik v'al ha'rosh v'tov. We live in the best part, the best part of Jewish history. There was never such a peaceful era in Jewish history like the Jews who lived in America in the last 70 years. It's peacefully, hardly any anti-Semitism, no persecution. But throughout the history of the Jews, there was so much persecution, there was always what to give up the religion about. How can we be the Yama Nivcha? How could it be that there's one God and he's in charge and control and he cares and he's a good God? How can he allow all of these disastrous things to happen? He was just obsessed with that.
So what's this whole mindset with Metatron? Why bring on Shuvu Banim Shalomim here?
Shuvu Banim, that's explained why he didn't try to do Shuvu. He thought that he had gone too far. And then he say he cried when he died, so somehow he assumed that he did do Shuvu. But later on he was able then to get in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the Avera is that, so he thought he was so far gone because of all the things that he just done past in his lifetime. He doubted God. He did certain things against the Jewish people, etc. So that was his aver. So when he heard Shuvah Banim Shovim, he knew it was, he thought it was speaking to him.
He thought that Banim, Shuvah Banim, Bein Goloyachem, that's a drosha, that's a standard drosha of the Torah Shofet. Acher Goloyachem and Bein Goloyachem.
So why is this drosha given anywhere else in reference to him?
You have other sources in the Gemara where they make a drosha, Acher Goloyachem, they have a drosha, Bein Goloyachem. You don't have a mispasim, so he understood on his own the drosha on this pasim.
So
the Paschal calls out to all of mankind, Shuvah Banim Shalomim, one who is still a bane. Afal Pi Shechata is still a bane, but not if he went so far.
So why is it after this particular Gadatan, this after this Maisa with Metatron, specifically?
I don't know. He thought everything can't be true. But many Jews have lived through the war. We lived in a peaceful era of Jewish history, so we're not bothered with the Kash. The people who went through the Second World War, the people who suffered at the hands of the Nazis, they were extremely shaken up by
it. Would it be crazy to assume that maybe this story, though, was the thing that pushed them over the edge? Because the Gemara decided, out of all of the mices that there are with the Lishib and Vuyah, to put this pasuk here? Okay, that's it. Shkaya, thank you very much.
27 minutes worth. So that's why I put my computer up, because I got the rest of it. Okay.
I think so, yeah.